We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. And Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Last fall, people in the West African country of Ivory Coast went to the polls to choose a new president. When the vote went against the incumbent, Laurent Gbagbo, he refused to accept the result. That led to months of violence that only ended when Gbagbo and his supporters were defeated militarily. In this hour of the show, we'll try to find out a little bit about what has happened in the months since, as we talk once again with Tom Bassett and Carol Spindell. They have spent a lot of time in Ivory Coast over the last couple of decades. Tom is professor of geography at the U of I. His research has focused on development and environment in Ivory Coast. He's done a lot of field research there ever since the early 1980s. Carol is instructor of English. Her experience also goes back to the early 80s when she went there with Tom. She wrote a book about her experiences getting to know the place, In the Shadow of the Sacred Grove. And in fact, she was in Ivory Coast for the election last fall. She did some reporting on it, and it aired on our station. And you can still hear those pieces on our website. And in fact, she won an award. She won a Public Radio News Director's Award for her commentaries on Ivory Coast. So you can check them out on the website, which is willl.illinois.edu. We talked last in January, January 3rd. They were there for most of the month of June, so we're pleased that they could both be here and kind of talk a little bit about what's happened since. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
No,
we appreciate
pleasure.
I don't want to try not to draw out the introduction too much more. I think when last time we talked, the first thing that we did was that we – so I sort of ask you to tell me the story of the last few decades of history in Ivory Coast. So I don't want to start there. Maybe the thing to do is again, sort of to go back to remind people, well, okay, there was this presidential election that's last fall. As far as the international community was concerned, there was one winner. The incumbent said, I don't accept that. So that's why we had this period of months, which finally ended in April, when the supporters of Alassane Ouattara won militarily, and the old president Laurent Gbagbo was arrested and is still under arrest, may face some variety of charges. How do we try to start to explain to people what has happened, at least just over the last few months?
Well, I could start just by a little bit of the emotional experience of it. This election was so critical because there had been instability in Ivory Coast since 1999, and the country had been divided in two since 2002. So when I was there in October and November, as many listeners know, many listeners heard my commentaries, I think, and there was just this tremendous feeling of hope that now we're going to go to the ballot box, and through this election, we're going to elect a single president, we're going to reunite our country, we're going to restart our stalled economy, and we're going to have a new, you know, era. This was the 50th anniversary of Ivory Coast's independence, and they're kind of looking forward to another 50 years. We're going to make it as a country. So having felt that hope and that optimism and that determination of Ivorians firsthand, I really felt the heartbreaking tragedy of what happened when on December 4th, Gbagbo, rather than conceding the election, inaugurated himself. He's a historian by training. He quoted Napoleon and pointed out that Napoleon had put the crown on his own head, taken it from the Pope. So there you have it.
Well, so then that was followed by this by 4 months of fighting between the supporters of the two sides, which then ended in April. It's estimated that maybe 3,000 people died. There was a lot of destruction. So now, once that happened, and then finally, eventually, Alassane Ouattara was inaugurated as president of the country. So what do people feel now?
Well, I think it depends where they are. The first people we encountered were people in Abidjan, and people in Abidjan suffered the most. That's the economic capital. It shouldn't be the political capital. It's not technically, but it is really. It's where everything happens in the city. It's an enormous city of maybe at least 4 million people, probably more. I mean, who knows how many people live in Abidjan? It's enormous, sprawling city by the lagoons, very dense. And basically, once the soldiers started down from the center of the country toward Abidjan, they were in the middle of an urban battle, these people. They were trapped. They couldn't get out, many of them. Some tried to flee the city. Many did. Thousands of people fled. But it was very hard to leave. Bus tickets were very expensive. And they were stuck there in the middle of this battle. So people, when Tom and I arrived in Ouattara had formed his unity government June 1st, and we arrived the following week. So it was very much a transitional moment, and people had a tremendous sense of relief, like the worst is over. You know, here I am. I survived the fighting. My family survived the fighting. Just barely. We were stuck in the house. You know, mortars were being lobbed into our neighborhood or whatever. We had no water, but we survived. But there was also a very realistic sense from people that we spoke with, and people just began to pour out their stories to us when we arrived. I think Tom and I represented the outside world to them. Here we were, and we were the outside world, and we were ready to listen. And people just felt a real need to tell us what they had experienced. It was really moving, actually, to listen to these stories. And we spent many hours just sitting and listening. But I think the horrible thing is, had there been a concession ceremony and had Gbagbo handed over, you know, the necklace of office to Ouattara, it still would have been a daunting challenge, what he would have been taking on in his new government. Many, many challenges to reunite this country, restart the economy, etc. But now it was really daunting. Now so much had been lost. Infrastructure had been destroyed. Ethnic tensions had developed into fissures. It was just... And the worst thing, I think the worst problem that we saw when we were there is that Ouattara did have to turn to these rebel warlords to take office, even though he had been democratically elected. And they had been marginalized by the whole election process. When I was there in October, their days seemed to be numbered. But now they were back in the center of the political process, and he was indebted to them. So that was really heartbreaking to see.
In terms of the political landscape, Gbagbo's party, the Ivorian Popular Front, has absolutely just disintegrated. They'd suffered a double defeat. They lost the election, although Gbagbo and his party did their best to prevent Ouattara from assuming power, as we know. And they lost the military conflict. The FPI leaders are currently either under house arrest, have been charged with various crimes, or in exile, principally in Ghana and in neighboring Liberia. So one of the major questions and fact that the country faces is the collapse of perhaps multi-party democracy. We have legislative elections coming up at the end of this year, and the coalition party, the RDR, that it's Ouattara's party, and the other main party, the PDCI, which was the former president of BDA's party, united for the second round of the elections and stand to sweep the legislative elections. Now, whether they'll do that as individual parties or as a unified party, that still remains to be seen. But what's more important, I think, is that an opposition party is lacking at this point. And I think for the health of democracy and for the stability of Ouattara's regime, I think it's important for the opposition parties to get back on their feet and present some candidates in that election.
Is it a problem that there are still, I'm sure, many elements of military and paramilitary organizations all over the country and a lot of people with a lot of guns that don't really have anything to do? And I think one of the things that I had read is that the government apparently announced this intention by the end of the year to demobilize something like 10,000 people. Well, that's great, but you have to give them something to do, a job. You have to give them a way to earn a living. And if not, it seems that presence in the country could be a real problem.
You know, Callan referred to our many conversations we had with colleagues and friends in Abidjan in June, and recurring themes in those conversations were the challenges that lie ahead. And security is number one, with reference to the proliferation of arms that Gbagbo gave to his supporters, and of course Ouattara's military forces gave to their supporters. And jobs is another major challenge, and national reconciliation. And of course, they're all linked, right? Mm-hmm. And especially the security issues. And that is, when we were there at the top of the agenda, and it still is, frankly, the return of the police and the gendarmes to the country and to the cities to replace the armed forces in the streets with AK-47. And we don't know who these armed forces are. They have uniforms. They have weapons. But who's their commander? Big question. So having the military, which is in itself divided, right? There's the victors. There are the Force Nouvelle, the new forces army that supported Ouattara. Then there's the defense security forces that supported Gbagbo. They have to come together and form a national army. That in itself is a challenge. Then you have all these last-minute recruits with weapons, and what is their fate? So there's lots of options being debated, discussed, and a lot of it will require financing to employ people, and getting the economy restarted is important. But yeah, these are, I don't know if Carrie, if you want to add to that.
Well, we saw that firsthand. I mean, the first day we were there, we went into downtown Abidjan, and there's all these young men walking around, and they have fatigues on, and they have AK-47s. But what they don't have is, when you think about a normal army uniform, there's like a battalion number, and a, you know, there's all kind of tells exactly what unit this person is serving to, and therefore who they answer to. Well, these guys didn't have anything like that. Now, when we went over toward government buildings and the army, young army men who were guarding those, they had armbands that said they were part of the new army, the FRCE. They had a yellow piece of cloth tied around their arm, and that signified they belonged to a certain unit. So they were trying to regularize those people. But all these other guys are just walking around. Are they opportunists? Are they patriots? Are they guys hoping to get a job out of this? Have they had any training with this weapon that they're kind of casually carrying around? So these were certainly questions going through our head. And if you can imagine a country with no police to ensure that you're not robbed, the police and the state trooper kind of people, all those kind of people, many of them fled. They were concerned that they might be held responsible for what they had done under Gbagbo, or they wanted to get their families out of the country. For whatever reason, they fled. And many of them have still not come back to take up their posts.
Well, has one seen in the country an increase in what you would just call basic crime, something that doesn't have any political motivations? But if we have people with guns, that could be a tool to make a living.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of crime, and in fact, during the battle of Abidjan, the main prison was liberated. 6,000 hardcore criminals were released, and that is a major concern, putting those people back behind bars. There have been some major human rights abuses in areas where Gbagbo supporters have in the past persecuted people from the north, or what we might call Ouattara supporters and foreigners. And there's a bit of tit for tat going on that is terrifying, in fact. And controlling that is a major objective as well.
We're talking about here recent events in the Ivory Coast in West Africa. Our guests are Tom Bassett and Carol Spindell. Tom Bassett is professor of geography at University of Illinois. Carol teaches nonfiction writing at the university. And they have a long connection with the Ivory Coast. And they've been there back and forth a number of times, going back to the early 80s when Tom was doing his field work there. We talked with him in January about what had happened last year in the fall when there was an election in the country, and they were back there in June, and we wanted to do a little bit of an update to talk about what's happened since. So that's what we're here doing this morning. And questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things that we talked about before and tried to get people to understand was that there was an important geographic split in the country between the North and the South, and that the former president, Mr. Bagbo, his power base was in the South. The man who is now the president, Alassane Ouattara, his power base is in the North. And that there is this real sense of, you know, either you're a northerner or the southerner. And that, I'm sure, complicates the business of getting people to think about themselves as being Ivorian and not just being a northerner or a southerner. Where is that project trying to forge some sense of national identity out of this thing that says, well, either I am one or the other?
Well, unfortunately, especially in Abidjan, that project lost a lot of ground. You know, people were really, when I was there, there was such a hopeful feeling, and there were all these public service announcements where people talking about, we're all Ivorian, and there were my favorite was the soccer players would run out on TV every 5 minutes, and the national anthem would play, and they would say, I'm from the North, I'm from the South, I'm from the East, I'm from the West, we're together on the team, you know, Ivorians united. There was really a wonderful sense of, we can do this, we can reunite, we are Ivorians. But unfortunately, Bagbo, his strategy was divide and rule, and he fanned the flames of every division possible. He divided women's groups, he divided Catholic groups, he divided Muslim groups. I mean, that was one of his big strategies. And so those little tensions that are always there in a pluralistic society they just deepened and deepened into big fissures. Now, many Ivorians we talk to don't care a lot about ethnicity. And they are ready. I'm amazed at Northerners, actually, willingness to kind of put this behind them and say, okay, let's go on. We don't want the same kind of government that we had the past 10 years where Southerners are penalized for being Southerners. We don't want to do that. And Ouattara continues to say that, and he has named a commission of dialogue, truth, and reconciliation. Religious leaders during the whole process, actually, many of them spoke out for cohesion, for reconciliation, for tolerance. They played a very positive role. So there are many people in Ivory Coast who are trying to play a positive role and bring people back together. But, of course, there are some areas where, like the West, P might have heard about the massacres in Douekwe. Listeners may have heard about that. Mm-hmm. In places like that, it's going to be very, very difficult.
Yeah, I'm optimistic. I think I share Carol's optimism that Ivorians can rally and forge a new cohesive nation. And that is the challenge, national cohesion, after at least two decades of divisive politics based on ethnicity, religion, and region. But I think we saw the first signs of that coming together in the second round of the presidential election when Bédié's party from the center of the country, among the Baoulé, voted massively for Ouattara. So, in fact, there's been a crossover, at least from the north to the center. There's been a regional coalition and a kind of multi-ethnic coalition that came together to put Ouattara in power. There's also other signs of course, the north and the south. Many northerners have migrated to the south. In fact, some of the one region, the lower Sassandra region, voted for Ouattara in the second round. And half of Abidjan threw their support to Ouattara. So there's these north-south divisions, although they're real in the sense of there was a buffer zone between the north and south that was manned by UN peacekeeping troops. And the north has, the north is still controlled by these warlords. There hasn't been the integration back into a national administrative structure that is really key here to moving forward. So, but I think that I'm optimistic that, as Carol said, that religion, ethnicity, region, these are not major preoccupations of Ivorians. I think that peace, stability, jobs, a bright future is what's matters most. And I think that with good leadership, with hard work, I mean, reconciliation is going to be, you know, emerge from the work of individuals in villages and in neighborhoods and bring people together from different groups and discussing the issues and recognizing their common interests and moving forward. And that's necessary. And I think we're seeing that happening already. And even in the West, there are peace committees operating in the Mon region, for example, where we see many of the real conflicts that divide groups, not just political, but there are also economic ones. There are land tenure issues, in fact, that are pretty divisive that are being discussed right now. And I'm optimistic that eventually these will be resolved. But leadership is key. And Ouattara has been talking the talk. And so we're hoping that he's going to walk the walk, right? This is key.
Yeah, let's talk with some folks here. Urbana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. First off, I appreciate you taking my call. This might sound like a little bit of an uneducated question, and if it does, I apologize. But I've been a fan of the Ivorian soccer team since 2006, when at least the World Cup narrative was that their qualification to the World Cup helped bring about a civil war ceasefire. And so this was briefly touched on earlier. I was just wondering what role, if any, soccer or even just national sports in general might have in creating more of a national identity and reconciling both sides of the conflict?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I'm an Elephants fan too, and I think the Elephants are a big force for unification in the country, for social cohesion, for unity. There was that moving story in 2008 when they played that big game in Bouake in the Rebel Center. Drogba went down on his knees on TV and asked his countrymen to come together. So I'm sure you know that story and you're referring to that. Other listeners might not. Didier Drogba is a huge icon in Ivory Coast. And if you follow Drogba in his career, you know, a couple days ago he got injured. So I hope he's okay. But assuming he is okay, I understand he had a concussion or something. You know, he is one of the best soccer players in the world. And just Ivorians are so proud of his success. I heard rumors when we were there, Tom and I, some people said Drogba has been asked to be on this Dialogue, Truth, and Reconciliation Commission. He would have a very powerful force if he were able to do that, because Northerners remain extremely grateful to him for that game that he came and played in Bouake, for that appeal. And he is a very powerful symbolic figure.
Well, okay. I hope that gets at the. I think that gets at the question. I don't know if the caller wanted to follow up.
Is there more?
Well,
yeah.
First of all, I appreciate your answer. I'm a huge Drogba fan as well, and I'm hoping he's okay. But I mean, does the identity, the national identity, really fall? I mean, on like at least for soccer's impact, fall on his shoulders? Or if say they were really successful in the next Cup of Nations or something like that? I mean, would that have really the kind of impact that at least it was said it did back in 2006 World Cup?
Well, the country will be following. They could be in the middle of the Battle of Abidjan and they'll be following the Elephants. I mean, people fanatically support them. They're fans, and the team is one of the big success stories of the country. But, would these people step out of their roles as players and maybe take a larger role in this truth and reconciliation and dialogue process? I guess that's the question I'm wondering about, and we'll have to see. I don't know yet, but Drogba certainly could play a very powerful role if he did participate. He has been a United Nations Goodwill Ambassador, and some media people are speculating that he might be a member of this commission. There was a wonderful group doing public service announcements when I was there in the elections, and they were called Footitude. And they would have things would play on the radio constantly, and the national anthem would play, and the soccer team would run out, and they would urge their fellow citizens to vote massively and peacefully and to reunite the country. And then Drogba had his own public service announcement. Same thing. He would come out and urge people to vote massively and let's reunite our country and let's move forward. So because of their success on the field, because the different players of the national team come from different parts of the country, they are beautifully positioned to play a role in this reconciliation process, and I really hope they will.
All right. Well, I want to thank the caller. We have some others. Let's go to Effingham next, line number 1. Hello.
Yes, 3 questions. Thanks, Dave, for taking my call. Who was Ivory Coast former possessor of colonial their colonial origin that arrived in Ivory Coast and their natural resources.
Okay, good basic questions. Tom, why don't you do that one?
Right. The Ivory Coast was a former French colony between 1893 and 1960, and Carol mentioned it had celebrated its 50th anniversary of independence recently. In terms of natural resources, the country is blessed in the sense that it's 6 degrees to 11 degrees north of the equator, so it has abundant rainfall. Tropical rainforests historically cover the southern half of the country and a wooded savanna in the north. In terms of its the economic exports and coffee, cocoa, timber, most of the tropical hardwoods have disappeared. The Ivory Coast is today the number one cocoa producer in the world. It will, this year, with a record harvest, produce nearly 1.5 million tons of cocoa. Also, it has oil resources in the Gulf of Guinea that and refines oil. So coffee, cocoa, oil, the main commodities, exports coming from, especially the coffee and cocoa from a small holder farmers with 5-10 hectares of crops. And so that's with the hope that during the post-electoral crisis, Ouattara called for a boycott, economic boycott of the country's exports. And so for 2 months, no cocoa left. And, of course, that was strategic to deprive Bagbo of resources to fight a war. But now that boycott ended and the exports are flowing, and the hope is that by 2012, the economy will be on track and growing again.
Yes. Thank you. And the third question is, worldwide, if I'm understanding the situation, even in the U.S., and I've said this many times before, that the difference between democracy and republicanism, which we are not a democracy in the U.S., we are a republic. And around this world, there is no working democracy that I've ever read about or know about. And democracy is a paradigm that would require the people to rule rather than a person or a group of persons. In the U.S., it's about the numbers in the Congress. I think it's around 600 somewhere. And there will be no peace until democracy comes. If republicanism is introduced into Ivory Coast, like it, Africa is torn to pieces by things like we are talking about. And when and if, would your, in your opinion, would democracy come there?
Well, I think the Ivorian government is set up along the French model, so it certainly is set up as a republic and based on French Republican ideas. So I think that's very much a part of the way the Ivorian government is structured. But it's difficult having a democracy. You have a very high percentage of illiterate people in Ivory Coast. You have 60 different ethnic groups, and many people don't speak French, the national language. So there are many challenges to having a citizenry that is educated about the issues and that feels free to exercise their vote in a way that, for example, speaks back to power and removes people from office when they have not acted in the best interests of the people. And I think, you know, with the events in Libya and Egypt and all over the world, this is a little bit of what we're seeing. We're seeing voters in that, citizens in those countries, and I think in Ivory Coast too, and other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, saying, hey, you know, our leaders are not acting in the interest of the country and of the people. They're acting in their own interests, and we want, you know, to have more of a say when we vote. We want to have a different kind of leadership. We want a meritocracy. I mean, that's what people say to us all the time when we're there. We want those people who work hard and are good at what they do to succeed. And that's not the way things have been set up for the past 10 years.
Mm. We're talking this morning about Ivory Coast. We're talking with Carol Spindell and Tom Bassett, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, bring your appetite for food in conversation. We begin a week of interviews about food and cooking with Chef Grant Achatz. He co-founded a Chicago restaurant famous for its avant-garde food. Ackett's lost his sense of taste for a while after being diagnosed with tongue cancer. He's now in remission and has opened a new restaurant. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by the Farmers Market on historic North 1st Street in Champaign, Thursdays from 3 to 7 p.m. The North 1st Street Farmers Market accepts link cards and features locally grown produce and meat, crafts by local artisans, cooking demonstrations, and family-friendly activities.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics. Tomorrow morning at 10, we will talk about Afghanistan with Edward Girardet. He's a journalist who's been reporting on Afghanistan for a very long time. In fact, he went there for the first time just before the Soviet invasion. He has a recent book that is titled Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. We'll talk with him tomorrow at 10. Then Wednesday at 10, we have a health topic for you. We'll talk about prostate cancer. Our guest will be Philippa Cheatham. She is a board-certified urological surgeon at the Columbia University Medical Center. We're here, as I say, weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can get the schedule by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. This morning here on the program, we have two guests, Tom Bassett and Carol Spindell. Tom is professor of geography at the University of Illinois. Carol teaches nonfiction writing. And we're talking about the Ivory Coast, a place where they spent quite a bit of time over the last couple of decades, going back to the early 80s, when Tom went there to do field research and Carol went with. She wrote a book about her experiences getting to know the place in the shadow of the Sacred Grove. She was there for last fall's elections. She did some reporting for us here at WILL. And you can hear that by going to our website. I also want to mention again that she won an award, a Public Radio News Director's Award, for her commentaries on Ivory Coast. So you can check it out on the website. It's will.illinois.edu. We have a caller here, and this is someone in Champaign County here where we are, line two. Hello.
Hi. Another nuanced question here. I'm skeptical of a lot of things. I think it's good to start with skepticism, and I don't know how close the election was, but my perspective is that after seeing what the UN has done in Haiti and running a fraudulent election on three different bases, I have no particular confidence that that election was run fairly. When you pile on that, the idea that Africa has been suffering the depredations of the IMF and the World Bank for quite a few decades, and that the one that won, who was backed by Westerners, has associations with one or both of the institutions, I could see that a person in Abidjan who is partial to the soi-disant, shall I say, socialism of the fellow who wouldn't relinquish power, would be skeptical of this in its entirety. I just heard yesterday that NATO has rehearsed a intervention in the delta of Nigeria. I know that's not entirely germane, but when you see the role of the West, I always like to examine that first, because maybe we can actually do something about policy from where we're sitting, as opposed to always declaiming the Africans for not being able to run their own affairs. Is that enough of a question?
Sure. Well, there's at least three parts to that
fine.
One.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead, Tom.
Well, let me just note that the election was 54% Watteau, 46% Bongbo. Was it fair and transparent? I believe so. The UN certification, when we were there in June, we spoke with a number of UN people about the election. And then Carol again was there in October. And I think we feel pretty confident that the election was fair. A number of observers, the European Union, it wasn't just the United Nations, European Union, the Carter Center, and as well as other West African observers weighed in on this. So what's interesting, though, of course, that 46% of the population voted for Bongbo, right? So that means that Ouattara has to consider their interests. Now, are they hardcore Bongbo supporters? That's an interesting question. And I think that what a lot of these people liked was Gbagbo's nationalism and his populism. His policies, you know, soi-disant socialist, you know, it's hard to see any really Gbagbo's socialist policies. His politics seemed to be of the stomach, really, and benefited mainly his close associates. We saw very little development in the past decade in Côte d'Ivoire along any lines, economic, social, whatever. It's true that Ouattara has ties to international finance. He's a successful businessman. His wife is a successful businesswoman, and he used to be the deputy director of the International Monetary Fund, which I think accounts for – so he has some skills, let's say managerial skills that may, we hope, be put to good use. Now, will they be for neoliberal kind of purposes that will benefit transnational corporations, local businesses, and leave the peasantry impoverished? Of course, that's politics, and we'll see how that unfolds. The role of the West, of course, was key in the outcome, in that in late March, of course, the forces loyal to Ouattara did descend from the center towards the south in 3 days, a lightning kind of four-pronged attack, took over 95% of the country without any obvious support from the UN or French forces. That said, Gbagbo was prepared for this. He had lots of arms caches in Abidjan and was prepared for this from day one. And he dug his heels in, and the Ouattara's forces were unable to dislodge him. He had these heavy weapons. And the thanks to a UN resolution that gave the green light to the – I mean, the UN had the mandate to take all those heavy weapons, because their mandate was to protect the civilian population, which was being pummeled by Gbagbo's thugs. But anyway, a UN resolution cleared the way for those heavy weapons to be taken out. And that was one of the recurring themes of our conversations with colleagues there. Of course, these are colleagues that are supportive of Ouattara. But they were grateful for international intervention, which basically was about a dozen raids, aerial raids, shooting rockets at tanks, very precise, in fact. We visited some of these sites and saw this. And think about, you know, the NATO air raids on Libya right now. They number about 7,500 at this point. Mm-hmm. So it was minimal international military intervention, but key. And many of our colleagues said that this prevented another Rwanda in Cote d'Ivoire.
So Mr. Gbagbo, after you know when the stalemate was going on after the election, he said, "Well, this was not a fair election," and in fact, he said, "Well, this was all about the French trying to oust him." And I think some people have indeed looked at the ultimate victory of the pro Ouattara forces and said, "Well, if it had not been for the military intervention of the French, it might not be the case that he would not have won, but it might well be that it would have been much more protracted. A lot more people would have been killed, and you know maybe the outcome was sort of uncertain. So, how does one assess the involvement of outside parties in this?
Well, that was one thing that Tom and I, as Western and as Americans, listened to Ivorians. And the first group of people who visited us when we arrived in Abidjan were mostly colleagues of Tom's, who are not necessarily close friends, but people he's had professional contacts with. And they arrived. And the common thread through their stories and their analyses, although, as he said, these people had supported Ouattara, was that had the French and the UN not intervened militarily, there could have been a Rwanda-like ethnic genocide in Abidjan, and many, many, many more people would have died. And they were extremely grateful for that intervention. So I share the caller's skepticism of these interventionist efforts and their intentions. I totally understand that. But I think we also have to realize that Gbagbo was this incredibly savvy politician who took advantage of just that skepticism and those neocolonial resentments that still exist and fears and worries in places like Ivory Coast and in other places that support them. And he manipulated those to his advantage, to his personal advantage.
At the same time, I wonder, thinking about what Mr. Gbagbo was thinking. Here we had the election took place, and as Tom said, here essentially it was the consensus of the international community, various kinds of bodies, that Alison Watro won. And the United Nations took that position, and the African Unit took that position, and the West African Economic Association of West African Nations did, and a lot of leaders around Africa said to Laurent Gbagbo, look, you lost. You need to leave. Why did he think he could hang on? What was it that made him think with all of that against him that he could prevail?
Well, for one thing, nobody knew how many arms he had stockpiled, and even the UN didn't know, apparently. And that's, of course, one of their failings. They have an embargo, and they failed to enforce it. So he had so many arms stockpiled around Abidjan. And some people speculate that he had decided that even if he could only hold on to Abidjan and the rest of the country, you know, was now under Ouattara and a different army and a different government, he would do it. But who knows what he was thinking. At the very end, he had control of the state media, and we haven't talked about media in this story, but they played a very powerful part of this equation, and will be very interesting to see what sort of charges media figures face for inciting violence. But at the very end, I was listening over the internet, and just before the state media went black when Gbagbo was arrested, and it was a very strange mix of biblical sort of apocalyptic quotations about the end of the world from the Bible. And various other strange everyday stories, a kind of rewriting of Ivorian history in which Gbagbo was the liberator of Ivory Coast and compared to Nelson Mandela. I mean, it's a very strange mixture of stuff that he was putting out at the end. So what he was thinking, I don't know. Some people say he was very much under the influence of his wife, Simone, who many people in Ivory Coast hate deeply and feel is at the base of much of the cruelty that went on. But, of course, I'm just speculating. Yeah. I really don't know.
Well, this was one of the questions we asked our colleagues. You know, what explained this inexplicable behavior? I mean, Gbagbo was trying to play this anti-colonial card and appeal to French countries to support him, but he was really isolated. The African Union, as you said, and the Economic Commission of West African States supported Ouattara from day one. So he was quite isolated. But we think that that his close associates that had profited from a decade of basically pillaging the economy for their personal benefit encouraged him to stay there. Don't give up the fight. And Gbagbo, he's a kind of a union guy, a socialist fighter, and
he's a feisty guy.
He likes to fight. He also saw he read the future in exile. And for him, exile is death. He has been in exile in the past. He was in France for a number of years during the early stages of multi-party democracy. But there's a sense also he just wanted to be president, even if it was just of Abidjan. The power that he seemed to just relish was at his hand. Carol mentioned the religious kind of dimension. He had religious advisors. He's an evangelical Christian, and his advisors would tell him that he was chosen for this job by God. See? And that feeds into the whole cultural dimension of being the chief, right? Who had the right to rule, and his people had to obey him. I mean, there's a mix. There's a cultural mix, political mix, economic mix, and then of course the he's counting on the weapons to keep him in power. And he had allies. He had Russia as an ally. Russia was supplying him arms. Mm-hmm. How'd that happen? We asked some UN people. I thought there was an arms embargo here. I don't know how these weapons get into the country. But in the end, you know, Russia voted against Cote d'Ivoire and the UN. He also tried to hold ECOWAS hostage, the Economic Commission of West Africa, because ECOWAS threatened to send in a military force. And he said to them, he responded, but what would happen to your nationals in this country if you send in... But that didn't work in the end. But it really was crucial for this final assault by the UN forces. And the French Licorne forces were part of the UN peacekeeping forces. Now that unfortunate 5 months is over, and the process of reconstructing the country and dealing with its aftermath is what he's facing and his government's facing. And we can only wish him well. We believe he has a lot of support. Both internationally and nationally.
And within the country. Mm-hmm. One other story that we did hear there was that President Obama called Gbagbo twice hoping to lure him to the U.S. to avoid bloodshed by offering him a plum professorial position in Boston. And unfortunately, Gbagbo would not pick up the phone. He refused twice to speak with President Obama.
And you know, in fact, that the president did call him and make this call?
Tried or was it
just
to make
a story? So that's not just a story. You believe, in fact, President Obama did call, and they said to Mr. Gbagbo, the president of the United States is on the phone, and he said, no, I'm not going to take that call.
We do believe this story because of the sources we heard it from, yes.
Wow.
High level American officials have told us the story.
Mm-hmm. For Mr. Gbagbo, he was arrested on April 11th, and just only very recently was he charged with anything. They held him pending charging. And the charges that have been made against him so far have been essentially economic charges, like embezzlement. People think perhaps that he should be responsible for some war crimes. So one wonders whether charges like that would be made and from where they would come. And do you think the people in Ivory Coast and perhaps the Ouattara government would just as soon this come from the International Criminal Court and they not have to carry out such a trial? Well, knows where exactly it would happen, but it wouldn't be the Ouattara government trying Mr. Gbagbo.
For a lot of reasons, I think it would be better for social cohesion and simply for the technical ability of the Ivorian court system. There are a lot of reasons why it would be better if the war crimes or crimes against humanity charges were dealt with by the International Criminal Court.
Ouattara has, in fact, asked the court to handle those human rights charges, and that domestic courts will handle the economic crimes. I mean, Gbagbo did empty the coffers of the West African Central Bank in Abidjan to pay his military at one point. Why did it take so long, right? I think they're sorting through the political implications of what's the capacity of local courts and the impartiality of local courts to judge these crimes, and what are the effects on national reconciliation of those judgments. So I think it was a wise decision to delegate the responsibility to human rights abuses, because Ouattara's forces are also are going to be looked at quite closely for human rights abuses, especially in the West. There's also some, of course, dimensions that we don't know much about. But what was the status of Gbagbo when he was arrested? Was he president or was he a citizen? He was a member of the Constitutional Council, i.e. the Supreme Court of the country.
So can he be prosecuted or not?
Right. So there's a number of technicalities that I think entered into this decision.
And will I'm sure that the Ouattara government would be very happy to see charges leveled against Mr. Gbagbo's supporters for crimes committed. Will they be as willing to see their own supporters charged and held accountable?
They're going to have to be in order for the country to move forward. Those people who committed crimes are going to have to pay the consequences. There cannot be these more years of impunity that there have been for the past 10 years.
Right, exactly. And I said that Ouattara seems to be talking the talk, but we'll get this is walking the walk. Are his supporters, are his commanders who put him in power, are they going to be charged for crimes? And I think that putting that decision in the hands of international courts is a good one.
Mm. Just a couple of minutes ago, Carol said something about the role of the media, and I don't know if we only have a couple of minutes left. I don't know if there's anything that you would want to say about that.
Well, it was just really interesting. I mean, we are so fortunate here that we have an independent media. There, you had a state-controlled media, and so, of course, Gbagbo controlled it. I mean, it was ringed with soldiers, and Ouattara's people tried to march on the state television station. They organized a popular uprising of people in the streets. They went toward the television station, and they were shot down. People were murdered in the streets. So they were not able to take it out. Now, there is a very active press in Ivory Coast, written press. However, it is very partisan. Every newspaper has a different point of view. So if you read the pro-Gbagbo press, Ouattara hasn't been installed by the neo-imperial West, and there was fraud in the election, and so on and so forth. And Gbagbo's supporters have not been charged, and this is terrible, and they're being held in house arrest without charges. And if you read the other press, they're talking about the need to move forward, and issues of development and jobs and employment and so on, if you read the Pro Watra Press. So it's, and they say that these people who've committed crimes were not really part of the army. They were people who were just tagging along, saying that they were part of the army, or people who got out of control. They have, of course, their own line. So it's very complicated. It's very interesting to see.
Just in about a minute left, what's the last sort of thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, again, Tom and I continue to be optimistic. One thing that I've remarked about Ivory Coast is that there's a tremendous culture of apology and forgiveness there. I think, you know, every culture is different. Our culture seems to be terrified of apology and have a very hard time with forgiveness. And I noticed that Ivorians apologize readily and ask for mercy, ask for forgiveness. That's a part of their culture. And in fact, while we were there, an evangelical minister issued a public apology saying, you know, we made some mistakes. We took some wrong positions. And I want to apologize publicly for that. So I think that this culture is ready to forgive each other and move on in many, many cases. And I just hope that happens because Ivorian people have really suffered. And
I'd like to say that I think the international community continues to have an important role to play. The UN peacekeepers, there's 8,000 of them right now in the country, and they have a role to play in the legislative elections coming up at the end of this year in terms of their conduct and their certification. But also, if we're talking about, you know, the army leaving the city and the police coming in and taking control and assuming their functions, then there's going to be a transition period in which the UN police forces are going to be helping out there as well. So there's still a major, and of course, the international development agencies that are providing funds to the country, helping them relieve their debt. There's a number of very positive roles that the international community can play to nurture stability, reconstruction, reconciliation.
Yeah. Tom Bassett, he teaches geography. He's a professor of geography at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Carol Spindell teaches nonfiction writing. And again, if you'd like to see some, listen to the reports that she did from Ivory Coast on last fall's election, go to our website, will.illinois.edu. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for having us, David.
So I think that this culture is ready to forgive each other and move on in many, many cases. And I just hope that happens because Ivorian people have really suffered. And
I'd like to say that I think the international community continues to have an important role to play. The UN peacekeepers, there's 8,000 of them right now in the country, and they have a role to play in the legislative elections coming up at the end of this year in terms of their conduct and their certification. But also, if we're talking about, you know, the army leaving the city and the police coming in and taking control and assuming their functions, then there's going to be a transition period in which the UN police forces are going to be helping out there as well. So there's still a major, and of course, the international development agencies that are providing funds to the country, helping them relieve their debt. There's a number of very positive roles that the international community can play to nurture stability, reconstruction, reconciliation.
Yeah. Tom Bassett, he teaches geography. He's a professor of geography at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Carol Spindell teaches nonfiction writing. And again, if you'd like to see some, listen to the reports that she did from Ivory Coast on last fall's election, go to our website, will.illinois.edu. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for having us, David.
WILL programs are made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting the Allerton Music Barn Festival, September 1st through 5th at Allerton Park. More information is available at www.allertonmusicbarn.com.
And that's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Much more in the way of news and sports and weather, other things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, September wheat up 3.25 at 8.69 1/4. The December contract trading at 8.95, up 3. September wheat in Chicago, 7.63, up 3/4. December, 7.99 1/2, up 2.5. September corn, 7.56 1/2, up 4. December, 7.70 1/2, up 3.5 March, 781.75 up 3.5 May, 785.75 up 3.75. September soybeans 14.32.5 up 17.75 November 14.40.5 up 17. January 14.49.25 up 16.5 March 14.49.25 up 16.75. September soybean meal 377.50 up 150. September soybean oil 57.52 up 92. August live cattle 113.75 down 55. October 115.10 down 10. September feeder cattle 132.55 down a nickel. October 132.82.5 down 45. October lean hogs 86.55 down 55. Outside markets, October crude.